So the scale, I mean, if you're talking about the meat industry, essentially you are talking about the chicken industry. Everything else pales in comparison. And so if you want to address factory farming, you have this is the key issue. This is the key issue that causes suffering and problems, and you can't avoid it. And it's also the one animal, that land animal, that is not protected by law in the United States. So we have an Animal Welfare Act. The Animal Welfare Act excludes all farmed animals, but we do have a federal law protecting animals during slaughter, and it's like a Humane Methods Act. But chickens are specifically excluded from that. And if they make up 90% of the farmed animals, it means there is really essentially no protection for the majority of farmed animals. And it's just an appalling situation that people are generally involved with on a daily basis because it's America's favorite meat. So it's like a moral urgency to look at this closely and solve it.
The host of Follow Your Kind podcast. Welcome to the show, friends. So Leah Garces is a founder of Compassion in the World Farming USA, and as of October last year, the first female president of Mercy for Animals, an international nonprofit animal protection organization founded in 1999 by Milo Runkel. Mercy for Animals is dedicated to preventing cruelty to farmed animals and promoting compassionate food choices and policies. You may remember our conversation with Leah from episode 24, where we talked about her journey right after she joined Mercy for Animals. This conversation today is about her new book called Grilled, Turning Adversaries into Allies to Change the Chicken Industry. Grilled details Leah's experiences working alongside farmers and food industry leaders, encouraging change through dialogue and discussion to reduce the animal suffering and shine a spotlight on the rapidly growing plant-based food sector. It is a really great read. I really encourage you to pick up the book. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, maybe your local bookstore, and I really hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Kind podcast, and I'm probably speaking very loud. My mic is out of control because I'm so excited to have Leah Garces back on the show with Mercy for Animals and the author of freshly off the press new book that's called Grilled, Turning Adversaries into Allies to Change the Chicken Industry. Welcome back on the show, Leah.
I'm so glad to be here again and talk to you.
Yes, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm beyond excited. I just finished the book last night, actually, as I was preparing for the podcast, and like you see, that's all underlined and the pages folded.
I can see that's had some attention, that book. It's got lots of dog ears and underlines and stars. I love it.
Yeah.
Can't wait to hear what you think.
And you just get it signed for me as well. So I really, really appreciate that. But yeah, I mean, it was really moving. And what I found interesting is there is so many different facets that can be interesting to people, right? It's not just a book about ethics, or it's not just a book about animals, but it's a book about environment. It's a book about how we can apply all these things that you learned through your work and professional life that's been dedicated to animal welfare to anything like our political situation today, and just how to deal with people on a daily basis, and how not to take personally and not to lose hope just because somebody is not instantaneously changing their opinion. But I want us to start from the beginning. So the book is focused on chickens. Why chickens?
Well, chicken factory farming is the biggest cause of suffering on the planet. So there, in this country alone, are 9 billion that are raised and slaughtered every year. And for me, we have to have sharp focus on that concern and that problem in the world. And I feel like a lot of people will say to me, I've stopped eating pork, I've stopped eating beef, but I'm eating more. What's happening is people are eating more chickens or fish. And really, that's not helping the animals. It's not helping the environment. And I really wanted to shine a light on that and get people to think about what is really America's favorite form of protein right now and think about what are the consequences of that. And if we want to change it, how do we do that?
Mm-hmm. And we'll get a little bit more into the numbers and into the scale of the chicken industry in just a little bit. But I also wanted to focus for a few minutes about chickens as animals, because as we are, you know, we are so used to treating our dogs as a valuable member of a family or our cats, and now you see all these videos about dogs making smiles or is like trying to say words, but sometimes it's harder for us to relate to chickens maybe, and a lot of people think that chickens are stupid. But I learned so much from your book that chickens have like these superpowers.
Yes,
that I was not even aware about. Can you talk about that?
Yes, chickens have superpowers. So for me, I think for human beings, we tend to relate to and have a desire to protect those that are closest to us. So our family members, our friends, human beings, and then it goes to mammals, right? Chickens are not mammals, mm-hmm. and neither are fish. And because of that, they don't share our vocalizations, they don't share facial expressions. So because of that, we make this uneducated assumption that they don't feel pain, or joy, or fear. They don't have pride, they don't have relationships or friendships, but they have all of those things. Mm-hmm. Physiologically, biologically, evolutionarily, they're no different than the dogs and the cats that share our home with us, but they end up on our plates. And so I spend a lot of the, you know, first section of the book delving mm-hmm. into that and trying to get the reader to think about chickens differently. And some of the nuances of that are really fascinating. And, you know, when I think about chickens, so they have amazing visual perception. So they can see both far away and close at the same time. So we cannot do that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as I say in the book, I can't even find my keys most mornings, right? Or my wallet or my phone. And they can perceive a tiny little bug in the grass far away and catch that bug. They also have the ability to orient themselves in the Earth's magnetic field, which definitely feels like superpower abilities to me. They can recognize the kind of feather patterns of flock mates and know the individuals. Like, I cannot tell the difference between different feathers mm-hmm. and different birds. They just are much smarter than we give them credit for. And part of the problem is our tests for understanding whether animals are smart or not is based on our own perception of the world. And this is called Umwelt, which is your perception of the world. It's like our view, our experience of the world. It's called Umwelt. It's an animal behavior kind of concept. Mm-hmm. And as a result, like, we perceive and test intelligence in other animals based on our intelligence. But other animals have abilities and capacities that we don't have. Like, dolphins have sonar, and bats have sonar, and chickens can, and many birds can orient themselves in a magnetic field. And if we were testing intelligence from that perspective, they'd be off the charts, and we would be a big zero, right? We can't mm-hmm. do those things. So part of our perception is based on, of chickens not being smart, is based on our own tests, our own intelligence, and only testing it through our lens rather than their unique capacities, their unique abilities, which make them uniquely intelligent.
Right. It's like testing the athleticism of a fish, but by their ability to run.
Totally. What a great analogy. That is a great analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. I really appreciate, too, that you describe that and you point out those special powers as you name them, because I think it helps to bring down the just crazy, insane amount of numbers of these poor animals who get slaughtered in one year into more individual, like, bite-sized or like more personalized and relatable story, because this is, I think, where we're able to express more compassion or maybe empathize a little bit more, is when we learn the story of the specific animals versus just having the numbers in front of our face. Mm. It's also really cool. I love how you relay the story of coming kind of to the realization of picking out this moment of what to focus on with the birth of your son. And that's how you went, and when you made a decision to kind of focus on that. And you were still in London at that point. Mm-hmm. And then you decide to move your whole life to Georgia. And I thought it was interesting because I knew that about you, that you did like live in Europe and you traveled all over the world with your profession, but I didn't know why you picked Georgia. But now it makes complete sense. I had no idea that Georgia is one of the most, you know, it's the like one of the birth states where the chicken industry came about. Can you talk a little bit more about that decision and your period in your life?
Yeah, I, you know, the birth of my son really made time mean something different to me. So I had, by the time he was born, had already been working, you know, for 8 or 9 years in animal protection. And I had been traveling the world before I was 30. He was born when I was 29. And before I was 30, I had been to more than 30 countries looking, and I was overseeing campaigns and programs regard to animal protection. So I had seen every kind of suffering that could exist on the planet, like stray dogs in India, bullfighting in Spain, campaigning against dolphins being taken from Fiji for dolphinariums in Mexico, and factory farming. And I kind of, with the birth of my son, came to the conclusion that, you know, there was just one thing I wanted to do now. And one thing I felt was like a tractable, solvable problem, because we're involved in it every single day as human beings. Therefore, that means that we as individuals have power to change this. We have actual power where you're like, a dolphinarium, I don't go to dolphinariums. Like, stray dogs, I don't live in India. Like, those are not bullfighting. Those are not, so they're, this is immense suffering we as most human beings are involved with and I can solve. And my time became extremely precious, because when my son was born, I was so in awe of this human being. But at the same time, I knew in 18 years he's going to leave, right? He's going to go off and live his own life and do his own thing. And I kind of even say in the book, like, if he's anything like me, he'll go to another continent to express his, like, full independence, which is what I did. And that meant the way I spent my time had to become ruthlessly efficient with what I'm going to do when I'm not with him. And that only accelerated when I had my second, when I became pregnant with my second kid. Mm-hmm. And it was when I was pregnant with my second son that I decided, you know, I'm kind of done doing everything that has to do with animal suffering, and I'm going to focus on this one problem that is the most immense suffering that is caused by this one way that human beings treat animals. And that I didn't really look back, and the move to Georgia was, you know, crazy and really hard because I didn't know anybody, and moving from like metropolitan progressive London to Georgia, I thought like this, it was hard. It was a very hard year finding my feet. But at the end of the first year, Compassion World Farming's executive director, Philip Limbury, called me up and he said, all right, I looked at your proposal, because I proposed to him starting a US office. And he said, I found the money, let's go. So he gave me like 2 days of pay and a laptop, and we were off, you know, and I was so happy. I would have worked for free, honestly, but he doesn't need to know that now. Yeah,
that is amazing. And again, just from our previous conversation too, and from what I know about your professional life and how dedicated you've been to this cause through your whole career, it's just amazing, but also another proof that you really mean business and that you're really serious and, as you said, efficient and intentional with the actions that you take.
Yeah, I think there are so many problems in the world, you have to be intentional. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's worked for a long time and nearly 20 years now, and we talked about this in our previous conversation, like you have to also cart, like, self-care is important. So you can't do everything. You have to focus, you have to be intentional about the work you do, and stay strategic while being balanced. So, but the first step to being balanced is prioritizing and making a decision about, okay, this is the thing I'm going to do. I'm going to focus on it. I'm going to focus on it for a long time, and I'm not going to do anything else, and I'm not going to feel bad about that. This is why I'm doing it, and this is what matters to me.
Yeah. So now getting into more of the numbers and into the scale of the chicken industry, I know you say, and in the book you describe in a lot of detail how and why addressing chicken industry specifically can yield us the most benefit for our efforts in terms of relieving the suffering that there is. Can you talk more about the scale of the industry?
Yeah. So the United States is neck and neck with China, but the two countries are the largest producers of chicken in the world. And as I said a little bit earlier, there's 9 billion individuals in the United States that are raised and slaughtered every single year. And overall, there's about 10 billion farmed animals. So we're talking 90% of all farmed animals in the United States are just chickens. And I don't mean chickens, including chickens for laying, like laying hens for eggs. I mean just the chickens that end up on our plate for meat. So the scale, I mean, if you're talking about the meat industry, essentially you are talking about the chicken industry. Everything else pales in comparison. Right. And so if you want to address factory farming, you have, this is the key issue. This is the key issue that causes suffering and problems, and you can't avoid it. And it's also the one animal, that land animal, that is not protected by law in the United States. So we have an Animal Welfare Act. The Animal Welfare Act excludes all farmed animals, but we do have a federal law protecting animals during slaughter, and it's like a Humane Methods Act. But chickens are specifically excluded from that. And if they make up 90% of the farmed animals, it means there is really essentially no protection for the majority of farmed animals. And it's an appalling situation that people are generally involved with on a daily basis, mm-hmm. because it's America's favorite meat. So it's like a moral urgency to look at this closely and solve it.
Yeah, and I think a good indicator of that is not only the animals are not protected, vice versa, there are laws like gag laws that protect the public, or rather prevent the public from seeing anything that has to do with factory farming and with chickens, and from preventing them from being able to see what happens in the slaughterhouses. And that has to make people question. I mean, what it is that happens in there, and what would the effect of seeing that would be if you're not even allowed by law to see what's happening?
Yeah, that's how bad it is. Is the industry have passed something like 13 states have passed laws called ag gag laws, which literally make it illegal to film and expose and do whistleblowing of the cruelties inside a factory farm. So instead of the abuser being punished, the whistleblower is punished when cruelties are exposed. It means Mercy for Animals does a lot of undercover investigations, mm-hmm. and there are whole states we cannot go in legally. We cannot report on the known abuses. And we have people coming to us and telling us from inside of slaughterhouses and saying, there is horrible things happening here. And our hands are tied, because if we go in there, we are breaking the law and our investigators will end up in jail. We try not to do that. That is a terrible situation for the public to be in. And it's getting worse, in fact. And we just had laws passed that speed up the line speed in slaughterhouses for both chickens and pigs. And the administration just last week passed a law saying that these slaughterhouses can self-police, that the USDA is essentially pulling out of these slaughterhouses and it's up to the companies. And there is really known evidence that when that happens, violations increase, because there's no punishment for violating them. And this should be a huge concern, not just from animal welfare, but from food safety, from mm-hmm. workers' rights. It's generally a lawless situation that the public are intentionally obscured from by the industry, because they know if people saw this, if they had privy, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, nobody would want to be involved with this, especially with all the meat alternatives coming from plants that are emerging. It's just, you know, I think it's very telling that the industry feels that it's necessary to pass laws that prevent us from seeing what's happening. They must have a lot to hide. That's what that tells us.
Absolutely. And then it's also interesting that in a post of that, then we have something like humanely raised on the packaging from that meat. And then there is really not a lot of standards of what that means. And it's really interesting you have that as a kind of a through line, or at the beginning of the story in your book, that you go on this quest of, you know, seeing this humanely raised phrase on the package of meat, and then going on this huge quest to figure out what it means, and then your story further evolves with Meat and the Farmer. Can you tell us a little bit about the humanely raised, if there's any meaning behind it, and then how it starts your story?
Yeah, so for me, it was in 2014, I was shopping with my kids in a Kroger, and I saw this label that said humanely raised on some chicken, and I studied it, and I look at labels. I mean, for a vegan, I spend a lot of time in the meat aisles, like studying the advertisement and labels, and this really struck me as like, what does this mean? And I tried to find out. I had my phone out. I got the meat manager, and I was like, what does this mean? And he was so annoyed by me, he ended up like dragging the box out from behind the counter, being like, I don't know, this is where it came from. And it turned out it was Purdue. So that was like, okay, I'm going to call Purdue customer service. And I still didn't get answers. I was thinking, You know, from my perspective, having lived in Europe for 10 years, if you're going to say those words, they should be tied to an animal welfare certification scheme. So I was looking for that scheme. I was looking for third-party auditing that verified exactly what they meant so that I could check as a consumer if that's what I wanted to buy. But there was no such verification. Mm-hmm. And that dug me down a really, that I went down a big rabbit hole then, basically. And as more I tried to look, the more I realized this was happening. And that then, by chance, led me to Craig Watts. And Craig Watts was a factory farmer contracted by Purdue. And he happened to be raising these so-called humanely raised chickens. And through a mutual friend, a journalist, we were introduced. And I, through that relationship, had the opportunity to see for myself firsthand, what did it mean? And I had tried every other option. I had tried to contact Purdue. I had, you know, tried that meat manager. I had tried to look online, deep research into what does it mean. And there were no answers. And, you know, this was 5 years ago now. And things have changed drastically because the companies have been held to account on this. And they have really changed their ways. But certainly at the time, that meant nothing for the animals. It meant nothing. And that was my quest, was like, what does this mean? And I need to tell the public what it means. Because it was, I remember at one point I opened up my refrigerator and I saw my mom had bought this chicken. And she told me, like, with pride, look, I bought the chicken that said humanely raised. And I couldn't really get into her with all the investigation I was doing, but it made my heart sink thinking about all the people that were like buying this thinking it was something else. Mm-hmm. And it's not fair. That's not okay. And it's really hoodwinking consumers. It's not okay.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking to see the marketing tricks that a lot of different food companies pull off in order to manipulate the behaviors of the public, but also kind of throw that little rope or the little stick to the consumer to try to hang on something to justify their bad habits or the behaviors that would like to believe in. And it is truly heartbreaking because people do believe that. Then when it says, you know, I don't know, vegetarian cheese or something, that basically just means there's no bacon in it or something. I mean, like the things that are the way that things are marked and labeled today, it's mind blowing.
Yeah. But I think that is like this, it's like the sand is slipping between their hands. And I think this day and age, it is the consumers doubt big companies. They don't trust them. And the only way to build trust with the public is through overdoing the accountability, overdoing the truthfulness. And I feel like there's been a really big shift in the last 5 years where we as advocates are holding those companies accountable. We are exposing when they are being dishonest and then they have a terrible PR situation on their hands. And we don't, every time we see labels like that as advocates, we come down on the companies. We hunt down what it means. We show the images, mm-hmm. and they never win from it. They never win. And so they're learning, okay, we have to stop this. And I think Purdue changed its ways, which is part of, you know, the core part of the book, is that they really turned themselves around. And they said, okay, this wasn't right. This wasn't the right way. And they began making changes that are not perfect and are not everything we want, but are definitely a step in the right direction, and they're much more transparent about what they are and aren't doing, and they're much more careful about their language and their descriptions of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And again, Purdue is such a big system that it's always hard to kind of unwind and understand and discern which parts belong where and like where to allocate the blame and direct our anger towards. Mm-hmm. But I think it becomes easier to understand the motivation, sort of how the things fell into place, again, when you break it down to the individual story. So I'd like to spend just a few more minutes on Craig Watts. And it's so easy to villainize the farmer or those who are involved in raising the chickens. But then, yet, I don't know if many people understand what the system is truly like and how imprisoned, quote unquote, farmers are to this system and how enslaved they are by them. Can you talk a little more about your kind of relationship with Craig Watts and how it evolved and maybe what his motivation or story was for coming out together, holding hands with you and exposing these horrific practices that ultimately make Purdue change some of their standards.
Yeah. You know, before I, so in the summer of 2014, I found myself in the living room of what should have been my enemy, Craig Watts. And until that point in my career, in my life, I had spent my whole career blaming and hating someone like him. And then here I was, like, in his living room. And there was a lot of thoughts that went through my head, like, why did he invite me here into his house? And why hadn't I thought about it more? And I knew why. The reason was why I just spoke about, which is I had tried every other way to find out what was going on, to see inside a chicken factory farm, and every other attempt had failed. So this was a last resort. So I didn't go there with like this big open heart of, you know, I'm going to change his mind. I really was desperate and just did this out of desperation. And it was the hardest step I took was stepping into his house and being open and listening to him. But then as I sat there listening to him, and I really can visualize this where we were sitting, you know, cross-legged on his floor, and he was showing me all these papers from years of his debt and seeing these numbers and hearing his story. It really made me, I went from feeling afraid to feeling ashamed and realizing I had never thought about him and why someone would choose to do this job. And the reality is Craig Watts, in 1992, he was in his early 20s, and he was wanting to stay on the land that had been passed down five generations. He had kids, or he didn't have kids at the time, but he was wanting to have kids and raise his kids there, and there were no other job options. He lived in Fairmont, North Carolina, which is the poorest county in rural North Carolina. The tobacco industry had basically bottomed out, and chicken industry came to town and offered an alternative. So here was like a way to stay on the land, to live this lifestyle and be his own businessman, and it sounded like a dream come true. So he took out $250,000 loan in 1992. Can you imagine us doing that? Like, it's unbelievable that is, and people do more now. Now it's like $2 million loan.
Oh my God.
So they take out these big loans that are arranged by the chicken company and the bank have these arrangements. And all that money is to build the warehouses and the equipment in which he's going to raise the chickens. And Purdue promises to give him chickens that are produced chickens, and then he raises them, and then they collect them at the end and send them to slaughter. And he gets paid basically on how many birds he gets to slaughter as efficiently as possible. And that payment he uses to pay off the loan, like a mortgage, flock by flock. And that works really well at first. But then after a while, the birds started to get sick because it's a factory farm. And the birds, you know, the litter isn't changed. They're living on their own feces with ammonia and dust and wall-to-wall birds. Like, you're living in a New York subway your whole life and, like, defecating right then and there. That's the life of a factory farm. So, of course, they got sick, right? And when they get sick, you don't get paid for dead and sick birds. And so he started to fall behind on payments and had to do odd jobs. And he realized at this stage he had made a mistake, but it was too late because he was all but an indentured servant at this stage. And there was no way out. So he just kept going. And even when he got close to paying off a loan at one point, they asked for upgrades to the house to keep up with modern practices, where they asked him to invest $100,000 more in equipment. And his options were either, you know, take that additional loan or have no income again and have debt. So he had no choice again. And so he took the additional loan out, and then that means he has to pay it again. So the payments are never ending. The birds are sick. He was totally fed up. And so learning this made me really understand that he didn't want to do this necessarily. And he was very frustrated by the unfairness of the process. And he also, I went back over months and walked the houses and learned the system through him, went with him as he found dead and dying birds and euthanized them and saw through his eyes what he saw. When I asked him, are these birds okay? And he's like, they're not happy and they're not healthy. but you know, Americans want cheap meat and I need to pay my bills. And those are important words for us to hear. Yeah. And the problem is very complex. Solving it is not just a matter of standing on your moral high ground and saying, stop eating chickens. There's complexity to solving the problem. And to solve hard problems, we have to be willing to sit down with people we don't agree with to understand why they're making their choices, because this will unearth solutions that we never thought of before, partnerships and pathways that we can't think of when we're just talking to people who agree with us.
This is such an amazing and touching story, and it's also so, even though it's so full of pain, it's also so full of hope, because it shows you that when looked at individual level rather than like just the system, there is so much hope and there is so much desire to turn in the right direction, and so it's. It makes the battle easier to fight, I think. And then also it's such a smart and wise and gentle and compassionate approach to solving not just that issue, but any issues, any of the political issues that are on the table today. It's the power of the individual conversation, and you talk a lot about that in the book. And as you said, as you mentioned, it's an ability to come to the table or to the place of your quote-unquote enemy and be able to be honest with them and be able to be open enough to listen and hear their story as well. What do you think was the breaking point for Craig Watts to actually take action and speak up?
Well, Craig says that he saw a Purdue commercial on TV, and it was the same one I saw and the same one we ended up using in the video that went viral, which talked about, it was Jim Purdue like riding in his truck saying, we treat our chickens humanely and our farmers fairly. And he was like, enough. I had enough. Like, I can't stand this lie anymore. And it was about them that, you know, I came in touch with him. And he, you know, said he was tired of consumers being, he calls it, consumers are being hoodwinked is how he calls it. He's got great, great words. And I think for him, he got very close to paying off his loan. So he felt, well, you know, he had a responsibility to do something while he could. And, you know, it was a risky thing for him to do regardless, because his neighbors relied on this income too. All of his neighbors raised chickens. He was afraid of losing everything and losing his friendships. And I was afraid of getting sued. I was afraid of being the cause of him losing his income. He had three kids. He has three kids. One of them's, you know, now in college, knowing that if he loses his job, what's he going to do? So these were all fears that we had to overcome to be able to join forces and come out with the story.
But then on the flip side, there's also there are solutions on the table. So there is the regeneration or repurposing. This farms can be used for different things. So maybe talk a little bit more about, it's not the only way.
Absolutely. And this was something that I learned and that I say to people that can apply to general social justice issues, is look for the win-win. When you're sitting down with difficult adversaries and you're trying to find a problem solve for hard, very hard problems, start from a place of solutions that you can both agree on. So in Craig's case, I had to really change my mentality. Instead of thinking, how do I put him out of business, or how do I, you know, destroy him as a person, as a farmer, as I had to think, what else could he do? What's another job he could do? And there are other ways to use those warehouses that they're using for chickens. And people are just starting to do this. And I'm starting to explore this at Mercy for Animals as a project. And those things include mushrooms, hemp, and hydroponic lettuce, and other options like that. And just last month, I visited with a West Virginia farmer who's mentioned in the book, Mike Weaver. And he and I worked together, and that's also in the book, to expose Pilgrim's Pride and how their chickens were being raised. Mm-hmm. And now he went further and he stopped raising chickens. And now he turned his warehouses that were raising chickens into growing hemp. And it's amazing, because he used to make about $30,000 off of his two chicken warehouses, and now he's going to make $600,000 off of CBD oil for hemp. And it shows that we can evolve. We're not stuck with what we have now. And in fact, factory farming in this way of production has only been around about 70 years. Mm-hmm. Like in the scheme of things, that's not even a blink. That's not even a perceivable blink of an eye. So hopefully this is a blip, a wrong turn we took for a brief moment and we turned it around. And I think we're starting to see signs that things are turning around. And I can, you know, my epilogue is all about like envisaging that.
Yes, I'm just looking at that right now. I'm going to read just a small paragraph, okay, if you don't mind.
No, and please do.
You should, listeners, you should read all of it. It made me cry. But it's absolutely beautiful, and it's the epilogue 2050, and just a spurt from it. My grandchildren are staring at the, well, I'm not going to read that word, at the houses, considering them. Some of the metal has been sold, stripped, and repurposed, but the houses are a thing of the past, relic, a reminder of a brief wrong turn. We almost burnt out the planet's light bulb. We almost let a terrible food system destroy this beautiful planet, the only planet we have, and all the creatures on it. Thank goodness we didn't. Thank goodness we were able to turn it around before it was too late. I have like goosebumps. But it's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I mean, it hasn't been that long, and it doesn't have to stay for much longer.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful that it was a brief wrong turn, and that we're turning it around. And I see, the human spirit can do terrible things, but we are also capable of amazing innovations, mm-hmm, and creativity. And I'm starting to see that. We see, honestly, 5 years ago, I would not have thought Burger King would be selling the Impossible Burger.
How amazing.
Or a couple weeks ago, KFC testing out a plant-based chicken nugget. You know, pinch me. But we're headed there. We're headed to this win-win where you see, you know, companies like Cargill renamed their meat department to a protein department because the writing's on the wall. They know protein doesn't have to come from animals. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's bad for the planet. It's bad for health. It's bad for their business. It's bad for their PR. And I think we can, you know, change is not inevitable. To accelerate it, we have to be active constructors of change and working with farmers, working with companies, and imagining that future is part of what we need to do as activists.
What do you hope to accomplish with this book?
I want people to really buy into the epilogue, the vision of the future. And, you know, there's a saying I won't get exactly right, but like, if you want to get people to build a ship, don't give them tasks and give them wood and break it down. Teach them to long for the vastness of the sea. Mm. And I want people to long for this world that doesn't exist yet, but that we can do together, and we can proactively achieve if we, you know, imagine that future together.
What a beautiful metaphor. Leah, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate all of the amazing work you do professionally and with writing this book, and just the amazing example that you are to the families around you, to the community in Georgia, and just around the world.
Oh, thank you. I really love our conversation. You're the best. Thank you.
Thank you.